Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would Oscar Wilde find to laugh at in the 21st century? It's a testament to his brilliance that Wilde's most famous play, The Importance of Being Earnest, is still very funny 120 years after its London debut, when audiences roared at its silly and self-absorbed characters, despite the fact that most Victorians went to the theater looking for a moral, and this story didn't even pretend to offer one. Through April 18th, you can see a new adaptation of the play that preserves all of the humor and much of the original dialogue, but gives the characters a colorful playground of a set, contemporary technology, terminology, and snacks, and even a bit of modern music. Lee Troll is director and adapter of this new work called Wild Earnest. Rob Wilson is set designer for the production, and composer Jen C. Keaton wrote original songs for it. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for people who don't know the original work, The Importance of Being Earnest, can you give us a little summary of the source material that you used to build Wild Earnest?
The Importance of Being Earnest was written late in Oscar Wilde's career. It was a big popular hit, received sort of mixed reviews. There's a really funny, very pathetic George Bernard Shaw review of the play that's like, oh, this is like old-fashioned and, you know, it's not very good. And it's stood the test of time. So it's a farce. It's written like a farce with mixed identities and people falling in and out of love, and a happy ending, weddings at the end. And it's, I think, has become his most enduring work. It's still done all the time in high schools. It's still done all the time in colleges. And is known for this sort of like super British style, really arch British characters, and a lot of sitting on sofas and eating cucumber sandwiches and tea. And it's about hypocrisy. It's about deceit. It's about marriage and some of the truth behind how the marriage works. And it's about dating.
And so there were people who told you, don't touch this play, right? You said people said you better watch out.
Yeah, after I was already doing it. No one I talked to before Kitchen Dog said, yeah, let's do it, let's put it in the season, said, don't do this, except for my own like inner thoughts and feelings and like, you know, the ghost of Oscar Wilde, but nobody else. So I just thought it was a good idea the whole time. And then it was announced and a bunch of people said, like, yeah, you shouldn't do that. That's a really bad idea. And I immediately thought, they are right. This is a really bad idea. But at that point, we were already moving forward. I don't know what it is that troubles people. I mean, there's always some people that get upset if you mess with Shakespeare, but not that many. It's pretty common to mess with Shakespeare. And certainly no one cares if you do something to like a Hans Christian Andersen story, or, you know, it doesn't seem to bother people that much. But there's something about, especially in the theater world, messing with an Oscar Wilde play, a perfect play. I mean, there's nothing wrong at all with Importance of Being Earnest, that troubles them. I think it's because he writes such clear, easy-to-understand text and dialogue and story that that everyone gets to be an expert. You know, so they know exactly what you changed, exactly what you did. And it's also an entry point for – it's one of the great works of art that you can really do in high school. I mean, high school kids understand it. They think it's funny. And the characters are fun and easy to play, dynamic, exciting characters. So, you know, everybody played Cecily when they were 15, and they're already mad at you for whatever you did to her.
Because I'm a research nerd, I actually went back and read the original before I went to the production. And you left a lot. I wasn't sure how much would be very different. And a lot of the dialogue is left alone, just with some updates and, you know, modern terms and a few swear words thrown in. That actually does feel more modern than if you had not touched the dialogue.
I don't think he would have liked the swear words. I really don't. I mean, not that – I mean, he would have understood it and he would have thought it, Oscar Wilde is who I'm speaking of now. I think – you know, he did not like vulgarity, and I think he thought of Americans as vulgar, which was part of the fun of that. We talked a lot about style as we were working on this, because nobody could figure out what the style was, including me and the artistic directors, Chris Carlos and Tina Parker, would always say, like, I can't tell yet what the style is in like early rehearsals, and it's because I couldn't name the style, and finally, near the end of this, I thought, oh, it's Importance of Being Earnest and Anchorman, you know, as far as like what the sort of acting style is. And if you think of Anchorman, you may think it's like one thing, but actually there's like weird fantasy numbers and like musical things that happen. And
Afternoon Delight.
Right. Well, and also a whole like, you know, they go to Pleasure Town at one point, you know, and it's this animated thing. And there's also pockets of real sincerity and romance in it. And then silliness. There's something about the American stupidity that I wanted to match with British wit that excited me. And I don't know if it would excite him. And I don't really care. He's been dead for a long time. I love his play. It belongs to me as much as it belongs to anybody else. And I just wanted to play with it.
So, Jency and Rob, with that setup in mind, you had conversations with Lee, and you—I don't know if you did look at the original or whatever—but what kinds of questions did you have to ask yourself about what you were going to do? We'll start with the music, Jency.
Sure, I'm just like you. I researched, and when a little bit after Lee asked me to write music for the show, I found this book in an antique store, and it was a little tiny version of the play, and I read it over and over and over. And so I kept thinking, I know that Lee is going to update it, and knowing that this is set in Victorian time, I went to go see what the popular songs were during that time. Well, it's things like The Band Played On, it's very rigid, you know, music meant to be danced to, but in a very formal way. And so I asked myself, well, what's another time period that would relate to this that we could update and modernize? So then I started looking at doo-wop and had loved all of those harmonies and the dynamics and singing about love, and it's just very nostalgic. And so for me, it was that process of taking something that was set in a very particular time period and playing with the other times and how you could modernize those times. So, yeah.
Did you feel a particular pressure writing lyrics to go with a play whose language has been so celebrated?
It's interesting because I think that because the play has a timeless theme of love, and love is so powerful in music, I looked at ways to talk about love, but it's updated. So now if you say like, if you say follow, those are now social media words. So if you're saying you like something, or if you're saying I'm following you, those mean very different things now. I do think that because the vernacular was kept so similar, and it's so complicated, actually, when you listen to the dialogue, because we don't speak like that anymore. So I do think since the music isn't in using the same language, it modernizes it in a way where it's kind of this open, very spirited moment in the show where you kind of look into these people as characters and maybe what they're singing about, and it's a little bit ethereal apart from the dialogue. So, but yeah, like Lee was saying, I also didn't want to mess this up, you know. But I was really happy, and I think it was interesting too for me to write music for other people to sing. Mm-hmm. And thinking when I wrote these songs that the guys sing a song and they're singing the do 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 do's in the song, and those were written for women to sing. So it's also playing with that little bit of gender flipping, which I think you'll see in everything in the show, from the costuming to the characters. It just really flips the whole world on its head. And so, yeah.
It seems like Oscar Wilde, had he had the liberty to do so, might have been okay with gender flipping.
Yeah. No, I gender was very important to me from the start of this. The first thing I wanted to do was find a collaborator that was female, that would have as strong a voice in what we were doing, and that could lead me in certain ways down certain roads. I actually listened exclusively while I was writing to a Spotify playlist I've created from weird songs that Jency would send me. They were all the sort of like, I don't know, female electronica, like robot songs. And they would really capture my imagination, and it felt really playful. Magical, sexy in an interesting way, and I do think that gender is something that I've always related to when reading the script. I'm a straight white male, and I've felt that way my entire life, but I never felt like the other guys. I felt a little different. And I mostly hung out with women. I was mostly always friends with women. I have lots of sisters. So there was something about reading Oscar Wilde's characters who were a little fancier, a little...
unabashedly so.
Yeah, yeah. And they dressed in, I mean, the image and how Oscar Wilde used to dress. And, you know, and he was married to a woman and had a family and had a young male lover, much to his eventual ruin. But there's something interesting. So I think he wrote gender in really interesting ways. And he has Cecily and Gwendolyn, two of the... female protagonists in the piece, do some really interesting things in the piece. And yet still they have to be classified as kind of girly, kind of flirty. And they actually make really bold moves. They do really astonishing things that break with the code of culture. And of course, the force of nature that Lady Bracknell is.
And I think that's a good point, because even though it's the importance of being earnest, I mean, the show is so heavily dealing with all of these very complicated things I feel like you go through as a woman, you know, jealousy and deceit. And, you know, it seems like things for the men are very simple. They're very straightforward. The dialogue that they say, they have their intentions on how they're going to treat a woman, whether she's pretty or whether she's not pretty. And for the women, their relationships with everybody are interwoven throughout the play. That's really interesting to see how they change and morph and as they meet different characters. So,
Rob, the set does a lot with light in particular. There's kind of a maybe you can describe it. It's a I don't know what you call that wall. Okay, I can call it a wall. Great. It's a wall, and it's got like these icons on it that will light up in various ways.
Right.
I was looking at that and I loved it, and it kind of draws the eye, and yet it's so different from what a set would have looked like in 1895. Was that just liberating, or how did you feel about trying to interpret this in a really modern way?
I guess it was about a year ago that Lee approached me about this play and about the set, and it wasn't, you know, I hadn't looked at the play at that point, and he said, you know, I want to design this play so that there's room for roller skating. There may be some sumo wrestling. There won't be any lounge chairs. There's no one going to be no fainting couch. So I need a lot of space. I want it to be bright pink, and we need to show different locations. So it's a big empty pink room. What can we do? And so that was a discussion we've had for quite a long time, going back and forth at happy hours and cocktail parties and meetings, until finally. Kind of decided this thing needed to be more of a device that would actually help carry the story along without intruding into the space,
which is what a set is by definition,
right? And so what we you know, Lee had some very you know, he had his Pinterest page that we were looking through, and I found my own directions, and it kind of coalesced into this kind of like a mix of Louise Nevelson looking at her wall sculptures, mixed with Mary Blair, who this Disney art conceptual artist who designed the, you know, the front of the It's a Small World ride, and Alexander Girard looking at these other designers coming up with these kind of like very stylized icons that kind of related stylistically to the stylization he was going to be doing with this his interpretation. And so it kind of all made sense that way. It's like it didn't there wasn't any kind of research as far as like what other sets had been done at all. And the vision hopefully carried through.
We're speaking this hour with set designer Rob Wilson, composer and lyricist Jency Keaton, and director and adapter Lee Trawl. They're part of the creative team responsible for Wild Earnest, a modern-day adaptation of The Importance of Being Earnest, open at the Kitchen Dog Theater through April 18th. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS. I
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard Broken Arrow by my guest, composer and lyricist, Jency Keaton. She was also performing that song. We also have set designer Rob Wilson and director and adapter Lee Troll. All three are here to talk about Wild Earnest, a modern-day adaptation of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, open at Kitchen Dog Theater through April 18th. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. We were talking in the break that this show has taken on a sort of life of its own through social media in terms of tracing the process from start through completion. I mean, the show's still open. How has that, did the early moments of just kind of documenting what you were doing on social media affect the process itself?
The cast loves doing it, and they were very suspicious. You know,
one more thing to do, right?
Well, not just one more thing to do, but there's a sort of preciousness that I like to get rid of when I'm working on a play that sometimes can be very helpful and feel safe. You know, a sort of like, hey, just come for the play. Just come and see the finished product. And so I was nervous approaching the actors about this, but Rob and Jency and Danielle, our choreographer, we're all pretty obsessed with social media, particularly Instagram. And in fact, some of the early conversations I had about the set was like, I want something that people want to take a photo in front of. And Rob was like, let's get a hashtag. And so we came up with this hashtag Wild Dog, which is Kitchen Dog plus Oscar Wilde. So it's Wild with an E. You can already tell I'm making sure people spell it correctly. I started saying to everyone at Kitchen Dog, hey, take a photo of everything. There's no surprise. There's nothing you can't show in the rehearsal process as we go forward. They have become very willing ambassadors, the entire creative team, all of the actors. And what's happened now is Rob and I were just talking about how you search the hashtag Wild Dog and you just see like your whole experience of working on the show. And I can't speak for them, but for me, I mean, once opening night happens, I'm not really around anymore because I'm not allowed to change anything. So, and it just makes me nervous to be there. For me, it's a way of actually staying connected to the piece, you know, seeing, you know, what audience members take a photo and
you see from different points of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So I can totally understand embracing that once everything is finished. But I wonder sometimes as like a patron, I find that kind of transparency really fascinating. But I would think that as an artist, it's a little bit risky because what if something changes? What if something doesn't work? What if, somehow you just revealed too much about, please pardon the expression, making the sausage?
Well, I think that assumes that everybody's watching really closely. And I don't think that's the case. I think what they're seeing is, you know, a couple photos a day of a really cool show they want to go see. And if somebody's watching closely, then they're the type of person that will be obsessive about it anyway. You know, they'll make sure to come and see the show. I think it's more about having a barrage of images. I think it's more about saying, hey, this play is alive. You're a welcome part of it. Embrace it. Don't stand away from it.
You also described it as a party play,
yeah,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of felt inclusive to bring other people into it.
And that's the special thing about social media is now the way people do use it is to research and dive deeper in. And Instagram, I think, is great because it's just an image. And so it's not like we're releasing long-form content like a blog or, you know, we may have been tweeting, but Instagram allows you to see the transformation and it's just showing a small moment. So it's not video. And I think, too, it's really great to get exposure for more of the people involved, because I think that it being in music, working with artists, working in the theater, working with actors, all of our worlds don't overlap very much. And so it's pretty amazing for Lee to have brought this group together where we all got to meet each other. We got to meet these actors and then really start to collaborate and go across our social communities as well for people to discover new local members of the arts community. So I think in that respect, too, it was pretty amazing to see people start to connect.
I think it's important to note that both Jency and Rob, neither one of them are theater artists at all professionally. I mean, Rob's never designed a set before. Jency does it, writes her own music for her cool band. Like, you know.
So why did you want them, no disrespect, why did you want them instead of people who do this all the time?
I love people that do it all the time, and I totally want to collaborate with people like that. Our costume designer, Melissa Panzarello, is a theater costume designer through and through. But I wouldn't have hired her if she wasn't so hipster and cool. I think that for me, I feel like people find plays boring, or they think they do. And what I'm going to say now annoys a lot of people because they think this means I'm dumbing something down. But I think that that comes from someone that sounds like they're elitist and snobby. Because that, oh, so you're so smart? I don't know. I don't really know what that response is. I think that McKinney Avenue Contemporary, where we perform, is on McKinney Avenue. And there's walking traffic. Where is there walking traffic in Dallas? There's, I mean, right there on that road. And I think the idea that we're doing something secret and special inside this building that's only for theater people just makes me want to cry. So having as many different points of view, being able to say to Rob, don't make a set, saying to Jency, I want your music, radiates out. And we've seen that in the audience. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a small house, so having, you know, four of Jency's friends coming to see it, or four of her fans, or like people that have worked with Rob and the with his cards or his in his graphic design, it's a way more interesting room. The theater people sit there with their, you know, arms folded, waiting to be impressed, and people that love music and art, they lean forward. That's the kind of audience I want.
I think that's a really good point, because even when I was writing, I was thinking it more like I was writing music for a music video. And so it's supposed to look a certain way and supposed to be really cool. And it is more of a visual. And then working with Rob and having those beautiful visuals in place, it really feels like you're inside of a music video at some points in time, which I don't know is the goal of theater, but I think it's pretty cool.
And it informed the choreography as well, mm-hmm. Danielle's work. And yeah.
But it was a vision. It's like you had a very clear vision of what you wanted this to look like and to feel like. And I think we all leapt on board because we had some understanding of what it would be.
Some understanding.
I'm always fascinated. I'm glad you touched on that, Rob. At the skills that particular kinds of artists have to have, let's say, a visual artist or a musician, in listening to someone who is not a visual artist or a musician try to talk about what he or she wants in a project. And I've had a very limited experience in dealing with people composing music. And there's a special kind of language that you have to have that somehow bridges the gap between all the special things that you know and the way people go, I want it more like flashier looking kind of, but without so much, you know, we make weird sounds. Can you all relate to what I'm talking
about? Absolutely.
That is exactly how I talk, actually.
Pretty much. No, it's like, especially with theater lingo, I've been involved with Kitchen Dog for 20-something years, but I hadn't been through a process like this. And I had to learn the lingo mm-hmm. and how to, even how tall Held Hall is, because I wanted to make the set as big as we possibly, tall as we possibly could in the space. So, no, there's all kinds of lingo and terms that you learn as part of the process. But they, same thing, the theater people learn your lingo as well. And so that's part of the collaboration. That's what's made this so much fun, because we've all kind of learned from each other.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see, because when you're in a band, you just go have rehearsal. You have practice, and then you have a show one time. You don't have a show, 30, 40 times. You know, you're like, okay, we're done. And so it was interesting, too, to work with the actors in the way that they're performing the songs as well, because they're dancing and they're singing and they have mics, you know. So we did a lot of tricks in the show, too. Like, I brought my vocal processors in, you know, to make it sound more like a live show and less like theater. But I think Lee did a really good job of empowering us as well. He wanted to collaborate with us for a reason, and, he, you know, with his vision, he empowered us to kind of create our own vision and our own space, which I think was really helpful. And then I would also get these emails that were just like, we need a cell phone noise. We need an email notification noise. And so it's interesting to sit and say, okay, well, what would this sound like in this world that Rob has designed in the middle of this, you know, updated version of the show? So it was a challenge all the time, which I think was great.
That can be hard for a theater to deal with. You know, Kitchen Dog is a not-for-profit business that has to meet deadlines and stay under budget.
I know how that goes.
And one of the ways that you do that is you work with people that understand the world. So it's pretty brave of them to. I mean, they knew who Rob was. It was easy for me to. Jency has a lot of music for me to play and say, like, this is the show. And also, I just put her on the title page of my. I said with songs. I mean, like, that's the play you decided to do, and to their credit, Kitchen Dog was like, all right, do it, and supported us very, very well. But I'm sure at times it was really annoying for the stage manager to say, like, who's taping out the set? And Rob goes, what does that mean? You know?
Is it my own tape? Is it yours?
Do I bring the tape? Yeah, yeah.
So people who know the original work may recall that at the end, when we have our sort of silly happy ending, we have the problem of two first cousins.
Hmm.
There are some things that have to be updated.
Right, and it's kind of it's that particular moment. I was thinking of the movie Clue, you know, where Tim Curry just runs around and explains who killed people like over and over and over again. And I just thought of Matt Lyle, who was already acting in the show as Algernon. I just thought it'd be really funny to watch him run around, and that we had a problem to solve. The end of the play, in our version, I didn't care for a long time, and then I kept seeing it and thought, you know what? I think once this is up and running, it is weird to not mention or talk about or fix the problem of two first cousins getting married. That's a real problem. And my original plan was to not update the script very much. And because I was really trying to build it as a piece that I would direct as sort of a theatrical event. That's what I was thinking of. Like, I want to put something together that's a theater piece. So in a theater piece, you just have something anachronistic. You just have, like, you know, a cool set with cell phones and things like that, and old-fashioned talking.
And just ignore the fact that something's no longer.
Yeah, this is a common way to adapt a play. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people really hate it, but that's a common way to do it. You know, they say, like, why do you have a cell phone? That the whole plot hinges on that being a letter. You know, that sort of thing. And the more and more I was working on it, I'd just kind of sneak a couple of things in. And when we do readings, I would be encouraged by Kitchen Dog and a lot of our company members that would come and listen, and they're like, more of that stuff. Go further with it. Especially because I kept talking about this sort of modern hipster. I mean, what I was curious about the whole time was I was curious about two things. One, does Oscar Wilde's play hold up without all of the things that we think of as being an Oscar Wilde play? Without sofas, without cucumber sandwiches.
Without cravats.
Yeah, what if I just change that stuff? You know, is it still a good play? And I would argue that it is. Even the people that don't like the play say, well, you know, I like the parts that were, like, super, you know, Oscar Wilde-like. I'm like, that's part of the point. Mm-hmm. So good. But the other thing I was curious about was the people I would see out in the streets. Like, especially, I travel a lot. So if I'm in Brooklyn or San Francisco or in Austin, sometimes in Dallas as well, at certain bars, people dress in these sort of, like, hilarious costumes. I mean, they're clothes, but they're costumes. And some of them are very old-fashioned. You know, they've got the mustache.
Mutton chops.
Yeah, the mutton chops or the twirly. Yeah, twirly mustachio. And some of them even, like, speak in a heightened, like, oh, I would like a Manhattan, please. And you're like, what is this voice? And they'd be there with somebody, you know, on a date. And I think, what is that like? How, are they both playing this game? Like, what's happening? And that is very much the importance of being earnest. That's very, very much what he was talking about. And I was just curious about that. And I guess my curiosity led other people to say, hey, go down that road a little further. So, but still, like you said, I'd say 80% of the
dialogue in the play is his.
It is remarkable that a lot of the things that are like huge plot points in a lot of classic works no longer work. You know, you think about in an era of cell phones, would Romeo and Juliet not have recognized what had happened? You know, and there are maybe fewer and fewer things, if we want to bring them into the modern world, that will work without adjustment.
Yes. But if you're talking about a great work of art, Romeo and Juliet would be a prime example.
No disrespect to Romeo and Juliet.
Is that what you're talking about is universal truth. You're also talking about plays that whose writers have long since been dead, and the plays now belong to us. They're part of our public...
the canon.
Yeah, they're part of the canon. They're also part of our culture. So there's nothing wrong with removing things and keeping and seeing what the essential truth is and wrestling with it and destroying it and defiling it and doing anything you can to it to dig down into what the truth of that is. And I think that that's what we aim to do.
We're speaking this hour with director and adapter Lee Troll, set designer Rob Wilson, and composer and musician Jency Keaton. Wild Earnest is a modern-day adaptation of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest, open at the Kitchen Dog Theater through April 18th. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
That is composer and lyricist Jency Keaton performing Return to Me. We are speaking to Jency Keaton, set designer Rob Wilson, and director and adapter Lee Troll about Wild Earnest, an adaptation of The Importance of Being Earnest, open at Kitchen Dog Theater through April 18th. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hey. Thanks so much. Another great show. I just wanted to say I got to see this as a matinee Sunday, and I wasn't certain what to expect with this updated version of the play, but I thought it all worked really well, particularly all those whimsical elements like the roller skating and the trampolines. There were things that I just wasn't sure how that would work, but it worked great, and I just wanted to say job well done.
Thanks so much for your call.
Phew. Good.
What do you, you know, I don't know how much you guys pay attention to reviews, or you try to look and see how the audience is responding, or just is it a matter of simply evaluating your own performance? How do you decide how well something worked and how much it matters whether other people liked it or not?
I read reviews because my day job at the Dallas Theater Center is that I'm a producer, so I produce new work. So I'm very used to reading reviews, and I like to know what's going on in the city and how all that stuff works. And in the social media world, you want to share something that is good
and makes people want to come to the show. So you have to read the review to find out. This is, I mean, it's a very stupid way to be as an artist. You should not read the reviews. It's Mm-mm. It's a terrible, terrible thing to do.
You should never read the reviews, yeah. I feel like, yeah. because a lot of times, too, and it's no offense to the people writing, but sometimes, especially for music, the people writing reviews, they're giving more of a play-by-play than actually analyzing what it was, I feel like, a lot of times. For me, I'm more interested to see what the audience has to say. And I've gone to the show a few times and just sat and listened to what people say after the show is over, which I think is really interesting.
What I find is that a lot of theater people, smart, good, professional theater people, are a little baffled by what they're seeing. And that regular audience members take it for what it is. I mean, they just look right at it and they just experience it, which is... a little more what I'm hoping for people to do, which is just sit in the room and see what happens. But I actually, when it comes down to deciding whether it works or not, I basically only use my own barometer. Has to be informed by what I'm seeing from the audience and what I'm hearing from people, even possibly what I'm reading in reviews. But I know what my intention is, and I know the parts of the show that really, really work, and I know the parts that aren't done yet, you know, that I want one more real pass at, you know, at another theater. I want to – there's moments where I just look at it and I think, that is almost the thing. And when you're making something visual that also moves through time and space, that also involves other collaborators, you don't know what it is until it's a thing. And I can tell when it has definable features, when it has texture, when it's saying something right to me. And I can tell when it's just like, well, that's a placeholder. You know, hopefully they'll laugh a little bit and we can move on. You know, that. And so I would say we got 80% to what I intended. And the 80% is so joyful and stupid that it's carrying the audience with it. So, yeah, it's a big hit play.
How do you gauge, Rob, what works? I mean, you sometimes work with clients, right, and sometimes do stuff just for yourself. I would imagine that the ways that you have to judge these things are different depending on who the intended audience is.
Right, and for this kind of judging the audience, you know, it's like I read the reviews as well. There were a lot of comments about the set. Everything's candy colored, Skittle colored, bubblegum colored. And even one comment about it looking, the back wall looking like an app for a phone, which I actually thought was interesting.
That's what I thought the intention was, actually.
Not at all. Not, well.
No, me neither.
Jump in and say yes.
I did. I thought it was.
Really? No. Yeah, not at all, because it was like such stylized icons that it's like it didn't occur to me. But I thought that was really perceptive because I didn't think of that myself. I think that it's been really great to have people be so excited about the way it looks, because it is so stylized. It has such a different feel than what you would ever expect for the genre. And I, you know, as far as like dealing with clients, like it's like you have to have some level of self-satisfaction of how you think the project turned out. And, you know, that Lee was happy with the way it looked, that Kitchen Dog was, that it gelled with the rest of the collaborators and all made sense. And I think slowly as it was being built, and we had some really great people who were helped building this thing, it started coming alive, a little bit of which you can see on social media, but you can kind of see this thing kind of gelling. And I was amazed. It was so much fun to see this thing. It's like, oh, wow, it's painted. It's a giant wall. These things are lighting up, and they're actually helping tell parts of the story as it goes along in rehearsal. And so it was really, really satisfying. And I kind of like you were saying, it's kind of your own barometer of like if you feel like it's successful or not.
I'm dazzled by everyone else's work in the show. I'm proud of my work, but there's some moments that I'm like, oh, I just really want to get in and then like mess with that. But when I sit and watch it, I think it looks like $1 million. I mean, every time I look at the set and see the props that Sammy Rios came up with, that the costumes that I see, and then when like the sound starts happening and the music
lighting
starts happening, I actually go to see the play more than I see most of the stuff I work on. I just find it enjoyable and pleasurable, and I just don't find a lot of theater pleasurable.
Do you actually – really? You don't find it pleasurable because you know too much about it?
Watching my own work, I don't find pleasurable at all. I find this one this much more pleasurable. Watching my own work, I just think like, you know, I let everyone down. But when I say going to see a lot of theater, I don't find pleasurable. No, I find it often very boring. I find it without any. I'm always really excited when I see a show that has some nerve and bravery and some rough edges to it. That dares to do something really bold, and I think a lot of the work that I see, and it's because I see so much work. It's not because the plays I'm seeing are bad or the artists that are making them are bad. They're not at all. They're actually really, really good. It's just I hunger to be woken up, and to be and for something new and surprising to happen.
It's got to be hard though, you know, when time and money are limited, even for stuff that is supposed to be pretty close to the ground. Like there's that question of, are you going to really just go for it, or are you going to avoid failure so that you know that you can get the money to do the next one? It's like the elves and the shoemaker.
That's why being part of a company, a Kitchen Dog Theater, and earning their trust, I hope. I mean, they keep letting me do weird things. Part of that, that's how you figure that out. No one's just going to hand you a goofy show to do. But also part of being a company is that I was afraid. I did hedge my bets on the show often, and the artistic directors and my crazy collaborators would say, like, no, go further. And this is KRA. Do you say further or farther?
It depends if we're talking about distance or degree. So
I don't know which one I'm talking
you're
about.
You're probably talking about further. Go further.
Okay, that's right. So being pushed to do that is an essential part of building a team. If you build a team full of people that just think the way you do, speak the way you do, like the same stuff that you like only, then you're not being challenged. And that's another reason why I work with collaborators that that don't often work in theater. That's why I work with so many women, because I feel like at a certain level, just a bunch of dudes in the room gets to be like, good job, bro. It looks great. You know, it's a lot of like congratulations and not enough of dialogue. On a different point of view.
How does fear work into the chances that you both take with your work?
I think with music, it's so personal, and there's the thing where you're writing what you're feeling inside. And for me, it's hard because with my old band, we wrote a lot about breaking up, and we wrote a lot of sad things, and it opens up this door for people who are also going through hard times to come in and talk to you. And not also gets a little scary sometimes too. And with my new project, Front 75, we are now playing electronic music. And so being in a new genre, a genre that's moving very quickly, that everybody's doing something new and tricky and new programming and working with producers, it does get a little scary sometimes. But I think at the core, I love music, and I would never be so afraid that I would quit making music, even if it's terrible in 50 years. And, you know, I think that fear is what drives. And for me, I think having something disturbing has to be in my life or else I can't create. So
I'm sorry to hear that.
I got married 3 years ago. And when you're happy, it's really hard to create. So for me, this was really great to work on a project where you got to write something happy, and you wrote for something very intentional, because when you're trying to pull that from yourself, sometimes it's hard when you feel like you don't have anything to say.
But I think too, it's like a professional creative, whether it's music or it's you're adapting a play or writing a play or you're creating something visual. You know, you are putting yourself out there. Your work is being put out there, and you're doing it as a professional. That's how you make your living. And it always sets you up for people to say, well, I could have do that. My six-year-old daughter could draw something better than that. So, I mean, no, that's something that kind of fear is, you know, that's something that kind of can spur you on as well, because it's like, you know, what we're doing, we're all professionals in what we do. And we, you know, we're trying to do the very best work we can. So, that kind of keeps that kind of fear of not doing the best work is something that can keep you going as well.
And that vulnerability is important, I think, in making art too. the notion that, hey, this is in some ways an expression of how I feel and how I think. And I'm going to try to make it as sort of naked and stupid and candy colored as possible, so that it's that, so it's a full expression of that. And that is scary.
Is there something liberating, though, about the fact that even though, you know, records are kept and reviews are written and people see things, there's something pretty ephemeral about a live performance of any kind. Like, you can have 40 performances, but no one is exactly like another, and no one will ever be able to have anything except their memory of it after they leave.
And then it's over. I find that to be the most exciting thing about doing live work and the most troubling thing. I mean, because it's the exact same as a human life. You live really, really, really important and meaningful and specific and painful and terrible things happen to you. And then you just die. And somewhere or another on this planet, there's either a memory or a ghost of you or there isn't, but you're not there anymore. And that's what I find really exciting about doing plays, because it reflects that almost exactly. There's a joke at Kitchen Dog where, you know, people will mention, like, some legendary show that's mostly legendary in their mind,
one left to question whether that was true or
right,
not.
Right, you know, and that I know is how we'll feel about Wild Earnest. I mean, I know that. So it leaves a mark in your own heart and your own space. And then when it's over, all that beautiful stuff that Rob makes is going to be put into a recycling bin and turned into another show. And Jency at least gets to keep the stuff.
Yeah, and I think for live performance, there's a different space that you go into as well. I think the actors on the show are amazing in what they're able to translate through the text, through this very complicated language, through the updates, through singing, through choreography. But it's them living in that moment, and it's everybody else living in that moment. And I read this really cool quote about how moments do become memories, you know, and you carry those. So by us continuing to create and us continuing to push within, you know, the local arts, hopefully anybody seeing it is either challenging their own view of what theater is, or they're experiencing it for the first time and forming their own opinions.
You can see Wild Earnest at Kitchen Dog Theater through April 18th. We've been speaking this hour with composer and lyricist Jency Keaton, set designer Rob Wilson, and director and adapter Lee Troll. Thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.